Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Commissioner Anslinger will give testimony on behalf of the United States government. Commissioner,
Mr. Speaker, Congressman, marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Ah, yes, the official government lie designed to trick the population into oppressing all those who own a Bob Marley record. But was it all a lie? The 26th of March 2005, a New Scientist magazine report is titled, Early Cannabis Use May Risk Mental Health. Tuesday, March 22nd, 2005, a Gazette Times headline reads, Sex Allegations Lead to Marijuana Discovery. March 22, 2005, Bradington Herald headline reads, Drugs Found in Home of Shooting Suspect. Stewart News, Florida, March 18, 2005, headline, Marijuana Allegedly Sparked Fatal Car Crash. A March 21, 2005 headline from the Associated Press reads, Authorities Investigate Body Found Near Bales of Marijuana. A March 2, 2005 headline from MSN News reads, Marijuana Can Trigger Schizophrenia. Was it all a lie? Not according to the government. Not according to the mainstream media. The two institutions you can always trust. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. We do have online with us our guest for the evening, Mr. Mike Gray. Are you with us, Mike?
I sure am, Dean. How are you?
I'm well, sir. Thank you for joining us. I thought you might enjoy that little intro, the words of Mr. Anslinger.
Always a pleasure to hear Harry Anslinger lying through his teeth, as was his custom.
As has been handed down, like it was the Ark of the Covenant to each drug czar.
Yes, indeed, right.
For those who may not know, Mike is the author of a book, Drug Crazy. I highly recommend it. It elaborates on much of the fraud that allows this drug war to continue. He's also a noted producer, director, has written a couple of screenplays you might be aware of, like The China Syndrome, one of my favorite movies. And he's the director of Common Sense for Drug Policy. Mike, it's a special honor to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Dean. How's everything down there in Texas?
It's still the Gulag City, sir. we arrest more people for small amounts of drugs than most states do here in this city.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, we have district attorneys and their assistants on the grand juries. We have a crime lab that is the scandal of planet Earth.
I've been reading about the crime lab. They pretty much made it up as they went along, didn't they?
Well, and they're still doing that. All those people that were sent to prison based on that evidence are still there.
Oh, boy.
It's a shame, but it's a, as I say, don't do this at home, folks, those that listening on the network. We have proven the futility of the drug war here in this town. And Mike, let's talk about your book, Drug Crazy. It exposes some of that fraud that we're talking about.
Well, I started working on Drug Crazy. I originally was going to do a documentary film because I figured, boy, this is, you know, all you got to do is go out there and interview people on all sides of the argument and cut it together, and you'll be able to shed some light on this subject. And, gee, boy, once I got into it, I realized what a swamp of lies and disinformation and, you know, I mean, and it turns out the weird thing is, we never had a drug problem in this country until we invented it for ourselves. At the time that the drug war actually began, back when they were ramping up for alcohol prohibition in 1914, we had at most, according to the leading authorities at that time, a couple of 100,000 narcotics addicts in the whole country. Now we've got 15 times that many. which is, if you factor in the population growth, a 500% increase in the rate of addiction since we started the drug war. I don't know where you come down on that, Dean, but I call that a lack of success.
Well, I think our good friend Sanho Tree summed it up best. He was on the show once, and he said, whether they have a successful year or a terrible year, they always need more money to fight this thing.
Right, right. And the drugs keep proliferating. There are more of them. They're cheaper. You know, here's the thing. The whole point of prohibition, I mean, the theory, the economic theory behind prohibition is, if you come down with heavy criminal sanctions, it will make the stuff so expensive that nobody will be able to afford it, right? Isn't that basically what they're trying to do, is
That's
to make,
what...
make stop the supply and make the remaining bits and pieces so expensive that no one will be interested or able to afford it. And not only has that not happened, the price of all of this stuff, the purity, the quality, has gone up astronomically. And it's better stuff now and cheaper than it ever was before. What's more, you know, new drugs are coming along every day. So, you know, while they say, well, we've licked the crack problem, you know, all of a sudden methadrine explodes in their faces. And it's not, I mean, where crack was limited to the inner cities largely for a long time, it turns out methadrine is in every small town, jerkwater, farm hamlet in the country. And the town that I grew up in, you know, a town of 800 people in the middle of the Indiana farm fields, now has major drug problems. You know, in other words, stuff that only, I mean, only a decade or two ago was, I mean, nobody in the country ever even, out in the rural areas, ever even heard of this kind of stuff. And now they got, you know, motels blowing up routinely as people are making speed out of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer.
Well, Mike, it's reminiscent of what happened with the alcohol prohibition.
Sure.
When the bathtub gin and the poisons were circulating amongst us, and the deaths and the violence increased.
Yeah, well, there's a new group afoot now. You know, law enforcement against prohibition?
Yes, sir.
And the members of LEAP, I guess it's called, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. These are former narcotics officers and, in some cases, former judges and current judges who are organized against prohibition because they see that this is just an absolutely impossible situation that's making the problem worse day by day. And I think that's going to have the most impact. The one thing that I've noticed, you know, like when I go to a Rotary Club and I talk about the failure of the drug war, maybe 20% of the people will be, you know, impressed, and they'll come up afterwards and say, yeah, we think you're right, it has failed. A lot of people just, you know, like, I mean, they cannot let go of it. They have to. But when a cop comes in, you know, a former narcotics officer like Peter Crist or Jack Cole, somebody like that, who spent their life in law enforcement, said, you know, like, I did this. I was in undercover. I did my best. It isn't working. And, in fact, it's making everything worse. And it's putting the lives of police officers in danger unnecessarily. And people are dying hand over fist in a gunplay, just like with Al Capone. I mean, Al Capone didn't kill people. I mean, Al Capone did not kill people because he was mad at them. he was doing, it was strictly business. He often said, you know, this is nothing personal, this is business. But when you're running an illegal enterprise, the only way you can't take your competitors to court if they infringe on your sales franchise, right? You got to shoot it out with them, and that's what we've got going right now. It's just and I think one thing that Jack Cole, the from LEAP, said that really impressed me was there. You know, people have demonstrated that they are going to get this stuff, whether we want them to or not. They're going to do illegal drugs. Now, the question is, who's going to supply it? Will it be... There are only three options. You can have private industry supply it and tax it and regulate it and use the money from taxation to mitigate the harm with treatment and helping out the addicts that do result from such a policy. Or you can have government dispense it and tax it and regulate it and use the money to mitigate the harm through treatment and whatnot. Or you can leave it in the hands of the mob with no taxation, no regulation, and 16-year-old street dealers at the front lines of this, the most deadly marketplace in the world.
How tragic. How tragic. Mike, we have a new segment that we've added. We have Phil Smith from the Drug Reform Coordination Network.
Yeah.
He's doing a weekly corrupt cop story.
This is Phil Smith with the Drug Reform Coordination Network doing this week's edition of the corrupt cop story. We've got several things going on this week. A 9/11 dispatcher gone bad in Perkinsburg, West Virginia. A former prosecuting attorney who took a wrong turn and has ended up dead in Macon, Missouri. But you're going to have to go to our website to hear more about those. The story I do want to mention today is the continuing saga of the Oakland Riders. These are four predatory Oakland police who were thrown off the police force in 2000 after numerous accounts of them beating suspected drug dealers and users, throwing down drugs, creating false police reports. They were, as I said, they were thrown off the force in 2000. They went to trial in 2003, as is too often the case. There was a mistrial. Jurors acquitted them on 8 charges, and they remained deadlocked on 27 more. But they are on trial again right now. That trial is coming to an end. Late last week, prosecutors gave their closing arguments. We are awaiting a verdict on these guys. They're some really bad boys, and we'll see if the jurors nail them this time. And that's it from Phil Smith and DRCNet. Check us out at stopthedrugwar.org.
All right. I want to thank Phil Smith for that.
Yeah.
Mike, corrupt cops, they're everywhere, aren't they?
Well, it's not the cop's fault. I mean, put yourself in the position of a cop. When I was working on the book Drug Crazy, I rode around with a lot of, I'm in the movie business.
Yes.
And in the movie business, you get to know cops because so much about the movie and television industry is about cops.
Sure is and these
I,
days.
I had access to some of Chicago's finest was able to ride with some narcotics officers and met the head of the narcotics operation there and so forth. And, they're very out front about it. They say, if you've spent 10 years at this on the streets, shooting it out, trying to bring this problem under control, and day after day you see it getting steadily worse, okay, and everything you do is meaningless. You put guys in jail and bang, the next day there are 3 guys there on the street that took their place. Instead of ending the drug market, all you're doing is just creating a new employment opportunity for whoever's the next guy to take over that corner. And after years and years and years of this, let's say you're chasing some guy down an alley and, he jumps over a fence and drops a suitcase, and you grab the suitcase and you open it up and it's got, $500,000 in it. Well, do you continue chasing the guy, or you figure this is far enough? You'd have to be an idiot not to sooner or later succumb to pocketing some of it. And once you pocket a little of it, then pretty much it's all downhill from there, because then it becomes a habit and then it becomes a necessity, When I was researching the book, I was driving the Mexican border from San Diego. I figured, look, let's look at the goddamn thing. I want to go down there and see the border. And I went from the surf at San Diego all the way to Brownsville, Texas, the Rio Grande, the full length, all 2,000 miles. And I got to tell you, Dean, any plans that we have for sealing that border? I mean, it crosses. The border is drawn on a map with a ruler, but that straight line crosses something like 5 major mountain ranges. Okay, there are spots in there where you could put Santa and his army in one of those canyons coming across, and nobody would ever know the difference, let alone an occasional drug smuggler. You know what I mean? But while I was driving down through Texas, in the Big Bend country there, the Rio Grande, I saw an article in the Alpine, Texas newspaper that said that Sheriff Tommy Thompson had just been arrested at the county fairgrounds. Turns out he had 0.5 ton of cocaine in his horse trailer, and Sheriff Thompson claimed that he was setting it up for a sting. But they didn't buy it. They thought that maybe he had an ulterior motive, since it was 0.5 ton. And that's the kind of thing you run into, And as I said, when the frustration on the part of the police, when they see that they're just simply spinning their wheels, that nothing gets done, it never gets any better, and the bad guys are making all the money, they say, well, why shouldn't I get in on this, you know? And you got to say, from, you know, looked at from that perspective, who can blame them?
It's just self-perpetuating, isn't it?
Well, not only that, Dean, but the worst thing about it is the drug war has corrupted our criminal justice system. As I said in the book, one of the things that astonished me the most was the routine lying that takes place in court, and it has to in order to make the system work. That's the nutty thing about what we've done here, you know? It's like when the cop testifies against you, he's got to say, well, officer, I saw Mr. Becker, on the sidewalk there, and he looked suspicious to me, and as I approached him, he threw a glassine bag to the pavement, and I recovered the glassine bag, and turned out it was heroin. Well, now everybody in the courthouse knows that's a lie. You know, you never threw the glassine bag to the pavement. What happened was the cop came up, grabbed you, proned you out on the pavement, and found the stuff in your sock. Well, he can't say that, because that's a violation of the Constitution. So he's got to make up another story and claim that he, you know, what you did was all visible and that you virtually invited arrest and so forth. And so the judge knows that the cop is lying. The cop certainly knows he's lying. You know that he's lying. The defendant, the lawyer, knows that the elevator operator in the goddamn building knows that he's lying. And what's more, everyone goes along with it, because if the cop is not allowed to tell that lie, you get off, and the system breaks down, and there is no more, you know. So what we've done is the most unforgivable sin of all. We have intentionally corrupted the criminal justice system by insisting that our front rank officers, the police officers on the beat, must lie under oath routinely, week in, week out, in order to make the system function. Now, that's crazy. That's just flat out insane.
Mike, I know that one area of concern that you have insofar as drug reform revolves around needle exchange. I think we've discussed that it's just crazy that we can't allow such a thing to happen. And this past week, a local professor, William Martin, here's just a little bit of an interview I did with him I want to share with you and our listeners.
I'm William Martin. I'm a senior fellow for religion and public policy at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University.
A few days ago, the Houston Chronicle did kind of a 1-2 punch in regards to needle exchange. Tell us a bit about that, if you will, sir.
I submitted an article supporting needle exchange programs to the Chronicle and was quite pleased that they printed it, and also extremely delighted that they waded in with a strong editorial of their own on the same day. And that's particularly timely because the Texas Senate is currently considering a bill, Senate Bill 127, to allow needle exchange programs. And the next day, I testified before the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services in support of this bill, and was pleased to see copies of those two items on the desks of a number of senators. And in fact, the bill was voted out of committee with only one dissenting vote out of six members.
Your op-ed states that it's troubling that 57% of children born with AIDS in the United States are the offspring of injection drug users or their sexual partners.
Well, it causes a substantial rise in the transmission of HIV and AIDS, now estimated that upwards of a third, probably as many as half of the people in the United States who get HIV infection get it as a result of either through contaminated needles or sexual relationships with a person who is infected, or transmission through the mother. Although in the last couple of years, that figure is starting to go down substantially as a result of needle exchange programs. A 2005 report from the Center for Disease Control estimates that the current lifetime treatment cost for a person with HIV is $155,000. And at current rates, approximately 40,000 people are infected with HIV each year. So just treating those who've been infected in the last 5 years for the rest of their lives will cost an estimated $31
billion. $31 billion, he says. Now, I don't know how else to put this. Professor Martin is very highly esteemed, works for the James A. Baker Institute. And if a man like that can present this fact and move it forward, we should all listen, should we not, Mike?
Absolutely. I mean, this the scientific evidence on behalf of needle exchange is overwhelming, you know, in terms of disease prevention and also in terms of getting people off of drugs, Dean. This is what the right wing doesn't quite under, I mean, the religious right doesn't understand about this idea of needle exchange. Once you offer clean needles, first of all, you're not encouraging drug use. That's one of the things that has been scientifically proven. Wherever these needle exchanges have been in operation, it does not have any impact on increasing the use of drugs at all. Quite the contrary. But what does happen is people who have been hiding from the law are able to have some brief contact with treatment people who are giving out these needles. I mean, the people who give out these needles, by the way, are saints. You know, they risk arrest, go into high crime areas and dispense this stuff, and they do it on their own, basically for no money, you know, at considerable risk to themselves you know, from the law, among other things. In many cases, they're doing this where this, you know, it's quasi-legal, where it's still an option that they could be arrested at any time. So what they are able to do once they establish contact is, in many cases, get some of these formerly hopeless cases into treatment and then into perhaps even getting out of drugs altogether. So that's the upside. And as far as the downside is concerned, the religious right would say, well, that sends the wrong message, right? That if we're giving needles away, that implies that we favor drug use. Well, that's nuts. Nobody's saying we favor drug use. What we favor is keeping people alive so that we can get them into treatment, so that we can get this problem behind us. And, you know, what the other side is saying, what the message that they want to send to our kids is, we're so screwed up, we're willing to kill people in order to prove a point.
It's a sad reflection on our society.
Indeed.
But let me first remind folks, we're talking with Mike Gray, noted author and chairman of Common Sense for Drug Policy. But I was going to say, it wouldn't be a cultural baggage show if we didn't play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. And we're also going to get to hear from our good friend Doug McFay.
Listen. It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Significant increase of psychosis, teenagers with schizophrenia, unfounded belief in the drug, arrest, incarceration, anal rape, HIV, and death. Time's up. The answer, according to today's New York Times, marijuana.
The U.S. Office of National Drug Control Policy is holding a series of public presentations to push drug testing in schools. What the drugs are probably won't include in his sales pitch is that research shows these school drug testing programs don't really work to reduce substance abuse. Pesky stuff, that research. Drug testing's biggest impact is at the polls. Some politicians think it makes them look tough, forceful leaders when they force kids to pee on command, and force the public to discuss it like this was acceptable. But it's not tough. It's tacky and short-sighted. Programs that work to keep kids from regular drug use, family counseling, alternative programming, those are cheaper as well as effective, but they require a real commitment to kids and an understanding of how young people think and learn. Now that's tough. These ideas don't generate the publicity urine testing does. But isn't it time our elected officials paid less attention to their press clippings and more to getting the job done? For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
I want to thank Doug for that report. Mike, once again, it's reflective of this drug war impacts so many aspects of our society. Let's talk about how widespread that damage is.
Well, it permeates absolutely everything. This would be a much different country if we just made that one change. I mean, most of the assault on personal liberties in terms of stripping our constitutional rights, if you trace it back to the origin, why the court made that particular decision, it was invariably a drug war exception. You know, in other words, yes, it's a violation of our constitutional rights, but the drugs are so terrible we have to make this exception. So it has infringed on, you know, a whole range of the rights as citizens that this country originally stood for. And it has corrupted the law enforcement, as we just said, and it's created class warfare, where one of the things that it has done is destroyed the inner cities, because the inner cities became naturally the drug market of choice, since drugs are always the illegal activity takes place where it is most tolerated, and where that would be is where the cops are less likely to be. And the cops don't patrol the inner city. They patrol the rich neighborhoods and keep the people from the inner city out of the rich neighborhoods. But so since there is less police presence in the inner city, naturally that's where the drugs are sold. But it's the white guys who are buying that stuff, and I've seen it happen. I was set with these Chicago narcotics officers on a freeway off-ramp, and you see, you know, like the white kids coming from the suburbs, zipping down the street, and, you know, making their drug buys and getting back on the freeway and whipping back to the suburbs. And people say, well, my golly, that must be terribly risky, those young white men, you know, and women going down to these terrible neighborhoods to buy drugs. It must be awfully dangerous. Those people are safer than if they were home in bed. Because the one thing that Al Capone taught all illegal marketers, you don't mess with the customers.
Right.
The customers are sacrosanct. So when those white teenagers go to the inner city to buy their crack or whatever, at least as long as they're in the neighborhood where it's being sold, they're safe as they can be. Because if anybody messes with them, they're going to have to answer to Big Daddy, whoever that might be at the moment.
That's a powerful thought. I hadn't quite looked at it in that context yet,
oh,
Mike.
Yeah.
Thank you. Starting tomorrow, Thursday through Saturday, the normal conference is happening out in San Francisco. I hope to see you out there.
I got to run, Dean, and I will be there, and I'm looking forward to seeing you. I understand, though, before we sign off here, that you just got a bunch of new stations, and I wanted to congratulate you before I hit the road here.
Well, Ed, I do thank you for that, Mike, and I look forward to seeing you out there, and have a safe journey.
All right, Dean. All right. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We've been visiting with Mike Gray, author of Drug Crazy. He is chairman of Common Sense for Drug Policy. And as I was saying, we will be starting up the normal conference here in a couple of days. We'll be giving you a in-depth report on that on next week's show. But for right now, let's hear from Canada and our good friend Philippe Lucas.
My name is Philippe Lucas. I'm the founder and director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society and Canadians for Safe Access, and I'm also director of communications for DrugSense. I'm going to be chairing the Canadian Issues panel this year, which is taking place on Saturday. We've got some great speakers that'll be on that panel. We've got Richard Callen, the former head of Normal USA, and we've also got Ian Mulgrew, a great reporter from the Vancouver Sun, who's writing a book called Potting, and Kirk Tusa, who's formerly of the BC Civil Liberties Association. I myself will be talking about a little bit about what's going on with medical marijuana in Canada, and our panel's theme is myth versus reality. I think that there's still a perception sometimes that Canada is closer to Holland or Jamaica than the U.S. in terms of our policy. And so we're just going to try and clarify some of the myths around Canadian drug policy. And we look forward to having a chance to talk about these Canadian issues at Normal, which is always one of the highlights of my drug policy reform year.
My friends, we own this battle, in particular for marijuana and very specifically for medical marijuana. We own this. 80% of Americans are for ending the war on medical marijuana patients. A majority, 50 to 60%, are inclined to ease up on the arrest of those who use recreational marijuana as well. We are up to 30 affiliates now. We want to welcome WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, WJSC in Johnson, Vermont, and KKCR in Hanalei, Hawaii. As always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please, my friends, be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.